personal experience of questioning what it means to be Australian in China led my last guest today, Sophie Loy-Wilson, to look at Australian migration to China during the first half of the 20th century, and it's just full of surprises, as you'll hear. At a time when the White Australia policy was in full swing, amidst anti-imperialism feelings stirring in China, white Australians and Chinese Australians travelled to the Far East, as it was dubbed, to try their luck at a new life, mainly for economic gain, not knowing they were actually the pilot, as it were, for future trade and diplomatic ties. Sophie's an Australian history lecturer at the University of Sydney, and as I've hinted, she has an interesting background that underlies her work in Australians in Shanghai, Race, Rights and Nation in Treaty Port China. Last year, Sophie made an earshot documentary for IRN about the life of Daisy Kwok, a Chinese Australian who travelled to Shanghai as a teenager with her family and lived a very full life there. So we'll hear about Daisy, just one of various sets of people who journeyed from Australia to China during the early 20th century, not the other way around. Welcome, Sophie.
Thanks, Geraldine. Great to be here.
Could you explain first what these treaty ports are, please?
They were a slippery colonial construction which allowed empires, the British Empire, for example, to come in and cede territory from a sovereign nation such as China. Shanghai itself began as a small fishing village, but with the arrival of the European empires after the Opium Wars, was divided up into foreign enclaves, a French concession, for example, an international concession. And in these concessions, the laws of these foreign nations reign supreme. So the nationals, say the French nationals or the British nationals that lived in these concessions, were subject to their own laws, not Chinese law. And this is what made treaty ports so unique and so interesting and so eclectic.
Okay, I mentioned you have an interesting background growing up in several Australian embassies around the world and in Shanghai as a teenager. That experience, I gather, influenced some of your thinking about what it's like to be the other.
So I arrived in Beijing with my father, and my family was posted there. My father was a diplomat in 1995, so 6 years after the Tiananmen Square uprising. And I really felt like a subject of intense curiosity. There were not many foreigners in China at that time. And I had to confront Chinese perceptions of Westerners and of foreigners and of Australians. And I think that's made me very sensitive to thinking about how Australians are perceived in China and how that might be informed by history.
You think we mainly think about the Chinese migrant story to Australia, but in fact, that's only part of the narrative. It goes back the other way, and this is what you've really fleshed out.
I was so excited to find that because as a young person wanting to understand the history of Australia's relationship with China, I was, you know, fascinated by Chinese migration and the gold rushes and those famous kind of historical events that we all know so well. But then to discover that the migration went the other way as well, that there were quite large numbers of Australians who went to China before 49.
And this is 20s and the 30s in particular,
right.
Depression era Australia.
Precisely, the era of steamships. And of course, you know, we're quite close to Shanghai as a port in Australia, and many Australians took the opportunity to kind of go and seek their fortune in Shanghai.
In that sort of, I bet there were a lot of veterans amongst them too, you know, who were sort of displaced by World War One. A Chinese Australian woman called Daisy is the main figure you write about in your book. She was born in Sydney at the turn of the 20th century, and she moved to Shanghai with her family. And she's a kind of case study for you, isn't she, to answer some of these questions? Could you very briefly give her some context for Daisy, please?
She was born to a very wealthy Chinese merchant family in Sydney. They sold fruit in Belmore markets. Her father was very successful, but in response to anti-Chinese boycotts of his business, he takes the family to China in 1917.
Anti-Chinese boycotts here because of things like the White Australia policy.
Precisely, the anti-Chinese leagues, which reared their heads around the time of Federation. So in response to this, Daisy's father takes the family to Shanghai in 1917, where he starts one of the most famous department stores, the Wing On department store on Nanjing Road. It still stands there today. And there in Shanghai, Daisy lived a very decadent jazz age.
And she spoke no Chinese because they spoke in English at home. So she She had to reorientate herself to this land.
Absolutely. You know, she didn't even have a Chinese name. Her father very much wanted her to have a crisp English accent. So in Australia, she only spoke English at home. They employed Australian servants. And this stood her in good stead in the Treaty Port era, but not so much when the communists arrived in 1949.
She did marry. Only Daisy and her sister Pearlie remained in Shanghai. The rest of the family left and went, I think, to California when the communists rose to power. And the communists took her husband, and after a few years in prison, he died. And she herself was singled out for quite harsh punishment, wasn't she, from the incoming regime?
So her family had been very famous as capitalists in the 20s and 30s. They'd been in the press. They'd been sort of minor celebrities. And of course, many of them had left, and she was one of the last to be there. And so she was the target of a lot of that resentment of capitalism and of the decadent Republican era during the communist period. So she was put in camps,
for example.
It's almost
like they'd sort of collaborated, like fifth columnists, with Western capitalism. Mm.
Exactly, exactly. And she lost all her belongings. They were all taken away. She was sent to slum housing. She had a very small amount of money to live on and was sent to the countryside, like many Chinese intellectuals or so-called capitalists at that time.
And she survived, and in the 70s and 80s she started teaching English for a bit of work. She only died in 1998, and this is the lovely little coda. She died as an Australian citizen, which she wasn't allowed to be, of course, in Australia, under the White Australia policy, and the Australian ambassador spoke at her funeral.
Yes, her funeral is attended by all these famous Australian dignitaries in China at the time.
So getting back to, in a way, what you're saying is the collateral impacts of the White Australia policy, I think, stifled businesses in Australia, which were quite successful, set up by Chinese people, and forced them back to China.
That's right. So we had these very successful fruit merchants in Sydney's Chinatown and Melbourne's Chinatown. And with the advent of White Australia, it became increasingly more difficult to do business. Many of their businesses were boycotted, for example. So many of them leave to go to Shanghai or Hong Kong. Often I think in Australian history, we assume that the Chinese-Australian community simply diminished in this period. But actually, if we look at Shanghai, we see that Chinese-Australians that left because of White Australia flourished in Shanghai.
And a lot of Australian, Anglo-Australians went to China. That's what surprised me.
I was fascinated to discover in the Shanghai Municipal Police Archive that there were many, many Australians there, many war veterans, many destitute Australians who were unemployed during the Great Depression end up in these police files. And that's where I first found them and thought, this isn't a story that I've heard before.
And in fact, you say that the British, the reigning British, pleaded with the Australian government to stop sending them because they were clearly a problem.
That's right. They were ending up destitute on the street. There was a benevolent Anzac society set up to deal with these destitute Australians that kept arriving. And so the British said to the Lyons government in 1932, please stop them coming.
Amazing story. So getting back to Daisy and Chinese people like Daisy, were they welcomed into the Shanghai Chinese community?
They were. They were known in Shanghai in the Treaty Port period as the Cantonese, because originally, of course, all the migrants to Australia came from South China. So in Shanghai, they were known as the Cantonese business people. And Nanjing Shopping Street, where they all set up four famous businesses, so four famous department stores set up by Chinese Australians on Shanghai's main shopping street. The dialect of their village was spoken more than Shanghainese. So apparently, you know, Nanjing Road was sometimes referred to as Zhongshan Street because the dialect was from Canton. So they really took over the heart of commercial Shanghai with their businesses.
And of course, as you make the point, Shanghai was full of migrants anyway. That was the nature of it. That's why it was one of the great cities and, of course, becoming so again. Look, Daisy's been written up by both historians like yourself from Australia, as well as Chinese. She's quite famous in Shanghai. How does the context of her life differ between the two national versions? And in a way, maybe that helps us reflect on what it means to identify as an Australian in China.
In Australia, Daisy's very much been written about, sort of, I'd say, as a victim of White Australian racism. And she certainly was. Her family certainly was. In China, she is written about very differently. Her Australian roots are often forgotten. She's written about as a doyenne of the jazz age era, a great beauty who then suffered terribly during the Cultural Revolution, but then overcame hardship to become one of Shanghai's most famous citizens in the 1980s and 1990s. So in Australia, we forget really her contribution to Shanghai. And in Shanghai, her Australian roots are sort of erased away. Very interesting.
Well, very symbolic in a sense of the amnesia one. That's how I read it anyway. I suppose that's what you're trying to say.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I sort of want to do here is bridge this gap between the way that we think about the Chinese in Australia and the way that Chinese Australians are thought about in China. Because what we see is this really fascinating history of engagement, like a long history of Chinese Australian interaction that I do think that we have some amnesia around.
Well, at the end of the book, you also show that there were people warning back then, warnings that could be replayed right now, that if we don't find a way to bridge these gaps, we'll pay a terrible price. So, and of course, it did become World War II came in the middle of it. But, you know, a real reminder that there were far-sighted people who saw the need for us to find more common cause. And we're still struggling with this.
That's right. And what they focused on was personal interaction. You know, it really was culture. So the emphasis of a lot of these, you know, sort of early advocates of trade with China, of greater understanding of China in Australia, John Latham, for example.
Who was in charge of the Australian Goodwill Trade Mission to China, wasn't he, in 1934?
Yes, imagine at the end of the Depression, 1934, we send this Goodwill Trade Mission to drum up trade with China.
And honestly, I find that so amazing. I've not heard anything like that before.
If you listen to what men like John Latham were saying, you know, they were saying we need to pay attention to how we're perceived in China, to how our history of Chinese exclusion is being perceived.
And mind you, he was still a white Australian man, though.
He was. I mean, this is the sort of contradiction of the age, right?
Look, just finally, semi-finally anyway, you move along in your book to the chapter on socialists, missionaries and internationalists who were also in China during this time. And you have a curious story that I wonder if you could expand on. In August 25, an Australian in China found himself in the middle of a strike in Hong Kong. And it was assumed by the Chinese strikers that he was English and therefore an imperialist capitalist, and he was detained and so on. On finding out he was an Australian, he was released, with the Chinese declaring, "Australia is like China, a nation oppressed by the British race." So what's going on there?
Yes. So here is an Australian, and many Australians at this time would have identified themselves proudly as British. Yet for these Chinese Union protesters rising up against the British Empire, he is also a victim of British imperialism.
Because the Australian, you discover, the Australian labour unions had put a lot of effort into similar strikes in China with, you know, the whole notion of the fate of the international worker.
Absolutely. This is the great age of union international solidarity. Mm. Newspapers are flush in Australia with reporting of strikes around the world and a lot of reporting about Shanghai strikes.
This is a film in the making. Sophie, congratulations on sort of winkling all of this out and telling these marvellous stories. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me, Geraldine.
Australian history lecturer at Sydney University, Sophie Lowe-Wilson, Lowe-Wilson, and her book, Australians in Shanghai, Race, Rights and Nation in Treaty Port China. It's published by Routledge. And as I mentioned, Sophie produced an RN Earshot documentary on the life of Daisy Kwok. And we've put a link up on our webpage where you can find the audio.